In a New Yorker profile of Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg last September, Evan Osnos writes, "If Facebook were a country, it would have the largest population on Earth, more than 2.2 billion people, about a third of humanity, log in at least once a month. That user base has no precedent in the history of American enterprise. 14 years after it was founded, in Zuckerberg's dorm room, Facebook has as many adherents as Christianity." But there's a dark side to that extensive success. Our next guest, Roger McNamee, is author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, from Penguin Press. And he's joining us by phone live from New York City to talk about the origins of Facebook and what it's become. Roger, thanks very much for calling in. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Ken, it's a pleasure. KBOO is one of my favorites. I visited you lots of times because in my band Moon Alice, we play in Portland and stop by from time to time when we're there. So it's very exciting to be on the phone with you.
And I am excited to have you on the phone. Not only the book, but I'm also a big fan of Moon Alice. In fact, in your role of rock musician, I've seen the band several times, but of more relevance to the book, you're also a longtime tech venture capitalist going on 35 years. In that role, how did you first get involved with Facebook, and what were your first impressions of Mark Zuckerberg?
So I first met him in 2006. He was 22. The company was 2 years old. And it's, so imagine, this is less than a year after the end of the period described in the Social Network movie. So he's still super young. I got an email from a guy who worked with him who said, "My boss is facing a crisis. He needs to talk to somebody who's been around a long time, who's trustworthy, and is objective. Would you take a meeting with him?" And I was convinced at that time, even though Facebook was really brand new, it had practically no revenue, it was still just your picture, your name and address, and your relationship status. So there was no news feed. It was nothing like the current product. But I was convinced that because he required real identity, you had to be a student using your school email account, and because he gave you control of your privacy setting, I thought that those were the kind of the magic jelly beans, if you will, that were going to allow him to build the first social network that didn't get overrun by trolls. And so when I first met him, all I can tell you is I had a very positive view, and I was able to help him that day, and that began a three-year period where I was one of his mentors. And my experience with him was fantastic. I mean, he was not, you know, your average person at all. He was socially awkward, but brilliant and idealistic. And in those days, the Mark that I knew was somebody that I admired and liked very much. I didn't see any of the sort of ruthlessness that's depicted in the movie, although I now know that that was there also. It just was never evident in my relationship with him. And so I became a huge fan. I eventually, you know, more than a year later, became an investor in the company on behalf of my fund. And it was the sort of thing where you know, I had a relationship that caused me to be a fan and to help him through some hard moments, but then to sit back, begin 2009, I was no longer involved day to day. And so I just sat back and watched the success, was very proud of it, until 2016, when I began to notice some things going on that really scared the crap out of me, that were really inconsistent with what I had thought was the philosophy and value system of Facebook.
Oh, Roger, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about those early days before we get to that.
Yeah, go for it.
You mentioned his idealism, and he was quoted as saying, "The goal of Facebook is to make the world a more open and connected place," which sounds very idealistic. Was that the initial mission statement at the startup stage?
Yeah, no, I mean, I always had the impression that he wanted to connect everybody who was online in the English-speaking world, right? And, you know, I had in my mind, imagine I'm doing this in my Dr. Evil voice. He was 100 million people, right? And, you know, in my mind, that would have been enormous, and it would have been very powerful. And I think he could have done that while maintaining the strict discipline on identity and privacy. But what happened was that it became very clear to him, in a way that I did not understand in those days, that if he relaxed the restrictions on identity and privacy, he was going to be able to grow a lot faster and go a lot further. And I remember in roughly 2009 warning him that going for a billion users was going to take him to places that he shouldn't want to go and force him to do things he shouldn't want to do. But I was on my way out, so I wasn't really in a position to help him manage through that. And, you know, now that I look back on it, that bothers me. And the reason I became an activist was in part that I felt like this was something I'd been involved in.
Yeah, and I don't want to...
I take you on that journey of discovery, that journey which I characterize as being a little bit like the Jimmy Stewart character in Rear Window. You know, I see something that looks like a crime scene, but at the beginning, I know nothing. In fact, if anything, I just know positive stuff. But I pull on the thread, and the book is really takes you on that journey of discovery. You don't need to know anything about technology. And by the time you're done, you know everything you need to know. Plus, I then help you understand how to protect yourself, how to protect your children, the kind of messages you should be taking to your elected representatives to ensure that they do what's necessary to protect.
Now, again, in those early days, and I don't blame you for this, but the problem with Facebook was what's called monetizing all their users at the time. And you were instrumental in getting the person hired who I think was mainly responsible for that new business strategy.
No, that's true.
That was Sheryl Sandberg, of course, who's currently Facebook's chief operating officer. She was tasked.
Back in those days, Sheryl was amazing. When I first met her, she was working with Bono. She was at the Treasury Department. She was the chief of staff to the Secretary of the Treasury, and she was helping to forgive the debt of emerging countries around the world that were, you know, had basically been loaned money under terms they couldn't pay back. And by forgiving the debt, she was going to give all of those countries a chance to start again. It was incredibly laudable. And you have to understand, that's the context in which I met her. She and Bono working together to help relatively poor countries get started again. And so, you know, for both her and for Mark, I knew them as idealistic people trying to make a positive impact on the world. And, you know, I think it's simply true that sometimes too much success can undermine your values. And I think that happened to the two of them.
Now, she was responsible, again, for that business strategy. There's a recent book called The Rise of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. She calls Sheryl Sandberg the Typhoid Mary of surveillance capitalism. I wonder if you could explain to the listeners a little bit about surveillance capitalism.
Shoshana Zuboff is a genius, okay? And the book, which is really huge, it's a doorstop, but if you're the kind of person like me who really wants to understand these problems, it's really worth it. It's truly brilliant. Her basic notion is this, that Google had an insight in 2002 that when it was doing what marketers always do, which is gather data from users in order to improve the product that you give to those users. And they were doing that, but they discovered that the search engine threw off lots and lots of interesting data that had nothing to do with improving search. So they did a lot of work to see what it was useful for. And they discovered it had value for predicting behavior across large populations of people. The notion was that you could look at search behaviors of the people on Google and figure out, wow, similar people are going to behave in similar ways over time. And so that caused them to basically realize that the more data they had, the better the predictions would be. So much more data would produce much better predictions. So they create Gmail. And Gmail was cynical two ways. First, because it gave them identity to tie to the purchase intent of search. But they decided to set it up so that they could read all the messages, and people let them do that. People who use Gmail, Google has these computers that scan everything you're doing, looking for, you know, keywords for, you know, that would signal your purchase intent or your behavioral changes. And, you know, take pictures of all the public spaces known as streets and all the private spaces known as our homes. And they simply declare, we own all this content, this data, we're going to make a market in it. Then they take our pictures of our houses from the top, which is what they call satellite view, and then they get in our faces with Google Glass, and they take pictures up close. And they simply declare all of these things are now market. We're going to gather all this data and use it to make predictions about each and every one of us. And that marketplace that Google created was something they hid from the whole world. They pretended as though they were doing something very different, that their only goal was to make their ads work better. And in fact, what they were also doing was using filter bubbles, which is when you give people only what they want, and recommendation engines, which tell people, you know, if you like this, you might like that. They took those things and twisted them so that they could make those behavioral predictions come true more often, make them more valuable. And that was incredibly cynical, incredibly dangerous, and that was something that at the time I just didn't see. And Zuboff wrote a book about that whole business model. And when Sheryl went from Google, where she was responsible for growing their advertising business, to Facebook, where she was responsible for creating an ad business, she took that idea from Google to Facebook. And it took Facebook a long time to figure out how to get it to work. It didn't work at Facebook until 2013, which was sadly 4 years after I stopped being involved. So I feel like an idiot now. At the time, I didn't see this, right? And when I talk about being Jimmy Stewart, just like, you know how Jimmy Stewart at the beginning of Rear Window, he's like, no idea what he's seeing. And you sit there and go, wait a minute, that's your neighbor. You should know what's going on. But I was a little bit like that. Just, I was an idiot. And
Roger. The subtitle, of course, is Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. And you were mentioning before that it was the turning point was about the run-up to the 2016 election when you woke up to that catastrophe.
Yeah. First, I saw in January and February 2016, during the New Hampshire primary for the Democrats, a bunch of my friends, initially just one, and then every day more people were sharing photographs with text on them, you know, what they call internet memes, depicting Hillary Clinton in various deeply misogynistic things. And they were all coming from a group that was ostensibly tied to the Bernie Sanders campaign. And it was the kind of stuff that no campaign was going to do putting their fingerprints on. And yet the thing was growing in terms of the number of people spreading these memes so rapidly, it suggested to me that someone was spending money to recruit my friends into this group. And that I thought was really weird and kind of evil. And then that was January and February. Then in March, Facebook expelled a group that was using the advertising tools to gather data about people who expressed an interest in Black Lives Matter. And they were selling that data to police departments, which was really, really evil. And so major civil rights violation. Then in June, I saw Brexit, which was the United Kingdom's referendum on leaving the European Union, where it appeared to me that Facebook's advertising tools were essentially enabling a campaign that had a really emotionally charged, kind of inflammatory message to get much better essentially cost of distribution than a campaign with a neutral message, because in that one the Leave campaign was very xenophobic and the Remain campaign was saying, hey, we got a great deal, stay the course. There was like no emotion in it at all. Then in October, the final straw for me was the Department of Housing and Urban Development cites Facebook for advertising tools that allowed discrimination in housing. And that happened, I believe, either the same week or a couple of days before we got the news that the Russians were interfering in the election.
Oh, and Roger, I have to cut you off. I'm afraid we're running out of time. You're in the middle of an event, I know, in New York City. It was very generous of you.
No worries. So I'm going to be at Powell's on Sunday night, 7 o'clock, and I hope people will come out. I'll tell more stories. I'll answer your questions. I'll help you protect your kids. So it's at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, and I hope everybody will come out because this is an important issue. And politically, we have the power to make the change, that this can be the issue of 2020. It's a right versus wrong, not a right versus left kind of issue.
Well, Roger, again, thanks so much for joining us at KBOO, and we'll see you next Sunday.
Talk to you soon.
We've been talking with Roger McNamee, author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, from Penguin Press. Roger will be reading from and discussing Zucked at Powell's Books in downtown Portland next Sunday, March 24th at 7:30 p.m.